Zhen Chen.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Good morning, everyone. I guess a few people want to have a little break right now. Let me start anyway. My topic will be the new ATSC guideline about the transport stream measurement, basically named A78. It's just been approved last year. In order to understand the significance of this guideline, and I think we needed to know some basics about the DTV transport stream data structure and understand how complex the DTV transport stream really is. So I would start to give some basic review of the DTV kind of data structure. Probably most people know those kind of stuff already, but try to spend the first few minutes. And then we'll talk about why it's important to actively monitor transport streams. And then we'll talk a little bit about the goals and the background of this measurement guideline, and what's the emphasis or the focus of this new guideline, and some of the practical examples coming from this guideline, and finally give a brief summary. As most people already know, ATSC DTV stream is really a type of MPEG-2 transport stream. And the MPEG-2 transport stream is formed by a sequence of 188 bytes transport stream packet. And each packet, you will have 4 bytes called packet header, and then the remaining 184 bytes, the packet payload, which carries like a video audio data. Each packet belongs to one elementary stream. It could be a video stream, could be an audio stream, or could be some data stream or metadata stream. And they are all identified by the transport stream packet ID. That's kind of the first part of the packet header. This slide shows the multiplex of the typical ATSC DTV stream. And for ATS stream, it will contain the PSI information. That's basically the MPEG metadata information. Any transport stream, if it's MPEG compliant, you must have those metadata information. And also, ATSC add some of its own unique metadata. Everybody knows that already, that's PSIP. And then you will have multiple video programs, or could have some audio-only programs, or some data programs. PSI, that's the MPEG data, metadata. It really stands for program specific information. It mainly contains just 3 tables, the PAT, PMT, and CAT. PAT contains really the root information of all the metadata. So in order to discover the elementary streams in your transport, the first thing a decoder or multiplexer try to find is the PAT. The PAT is always carried in bit 0, so it's easy to find. And once you find the PAT, by decoding PAT, you will find information about the PMT. And then PMT will have information about the elementary streams that belong to this program. So this slide shows the hierarchical relationship between PAT and PMT. Now, PAT is quite a simple table. It basically just have a list of all the program informations, contain just the 2 fields. One is the PMT, one is the program number, and the second is the PMT PID. Basically tell the decoders or the multiplexers where to find those PMT. And then PMT in turn has information such as a video PID, audio PID, and a PCR PID. Let's talk a little bit about PSIP. PSIP mainly serves three functions. The first is to carry the branding information. Since you know most broadcasters have been broadcast analog signals on a certain channel for a long time, so once they move transition to digital TV and their physical broadcast frequency band will not be the same as the old analog frequency band. But most broadcasters would want to carry the original channel number. So in order to carry the original channel number, you should have some kind of mapping information in your data just to tell the receivers, when the viewers click channel 4, instead of finding the standard analog frequency, channel 4, you need to move to a new digital frequency. So that's the information carried by PSIP. The second function of PSIP is to enable the rating information and also the content information. So help like the enable like the VCHIP technology to certain to block certain programs. And the majority of the piece of data is actually electronic program information, so that's provide the guide information. From MPEG standard point of view, PSIP is really just a type of private data. It is not announced by the MPEG metadata, and it is just defined in a certain PID. The base PSIP tables are always carried in PID 0x1FFB. So even though kind of all everyone using the ATSC system all know about the PSIP, but from MPEG point of standard view, it's really just the type of private data, and it's always present on PID 0x1FFB. There are four type of base tables. So those four tables, because they carry in PID 0x1FFB, most people call them base tables, or some people call them static PSIP. Those including the master guide table. MGT has a list of all the other PSIP data, including their PID, the version number of the tables, and also the length in terms of bytes of all other tables. So in order to decode PSIP, the first thing you need to decode is the MGT. And the second table carried on PID 0x1FFB is the system timetable. That is a very simple table. It just carries the UTC time information. And then a more complicated table is the virtual channel table. That has a list of all the program informations. And the other one is the rating region table. That's kind of optional actually in United States, because the entire US is the region one, so everybody knows that. There are two other tables that are not carried in PID 0x1FFB. One is called EIT. That contains the majority of the event information that basically includes the electronic program guide information. And ETT, it's called extended text table, and has additional information about your event. ETT is also optional on ATSC standard. So because ATSC transport streams carry two set of metadata. You know, one is MPEG-2 PSI information, the other is PSIP information. So there are certain overlap of data or their duplication of certain information in ATSC transport stream. A decoder actually can use either one of those informations to discover the elementary stream. But typical ATSC-enabled decoders, they probably would using like a piece of information, basically the VCT data to decode the program. The reason is because there is a link between VCT and all the electronic program guide, namely the source ID. So when the users first look at the electronic program guide and they select a virtual channel from the electronic program guide, that guide will have a direct link to a virtual channel information in VCT. So it makes sense for ATSC-enabled decoders first use the PSIP to decode the program. But when the PSIP is not there, then most decoders will fall back to MPEG metadata, namely PAT and PMT, to discover the elementary stream. On the other hand, when the broadcast stream are broadcast in kind of cable environment, since the cable operators, they will always need to remultiplex the transport stream, since the QAM transport stream has a higher bandwidth than 8VSB transport stream. So they will remultiplex and put your broadcast stream with something else together to form a QAM channel. In this case, the multiplexer will always using MPEG information to discover the program elements. You know, the reason is because in cable environment, lots of channels still don't have a piece of data. So it makes sense, you know, they just have one approach, namely using MPEG metadata to discover all the different programs. So that's why I think it is essential for broadcasters to have both of those metadata that, you know, are correctly encoded in the transport stream. Otherwise, you will see situations, you know, maybe you can view the program in your head end or in your broadcasting plant, but after those transport streams are carried by cable, the cable setup boxes cannot decode it anymore. So you need to make sure both of those metadata are correct. So we look at kind of the basic data structure of ATSC transport stream, and we certainly appreciate, you know, there are lots of data over there. Especially all those packet has to arrive to the decoder in the correct timing fashion. So it's really quite complex to make every piece work together, and. Especially because DTV decoding involves lots of softwares, and different decoders can have a slightly different implementation of their decoding algorithm. So sometimes one decoder can view a program, next decoder may not be able to. So that's why I think it's kind of important to monitor or test your transport stream, and really not just rely on certain decoders, but really test against the standard to see if your transport stream is standard compliant. You know, if it's standard compliant, it's most likely, you know, at least the majority of the decoders will be able to tune to your program. But just as mentioned already, one decoder can tune to your program. Does not mean other decoders can. Also, once you have a problem, you know, because of the complexity of the DTV transport stream, it's also not easy to actually isolate the cause of the problem. So if you are actively monitoring those transport streams, and hopefully those analyzers can point to you, you know, where the cause of the problem, so at least it can save you some time. When the problem happens, you actually can fix the problem. Here are just a few common DTV system defects. You know, we see lots of times the metadata can get into trouble. You know, some transport streams may be missing some of the PAT, PMT information, or some can be missing some piece of information. So those is a kind of one common problem. And the second common problem is normally related to the timing. You'll see, you know, excessive PCR jitter and those type of stuff. And the audio and the video buffer overflow and underflow are also common problems. Elementary streams missing, or some collect synchronization. So those are typical problems that you will find from DTV transport stream. They could have many different causes, but those are probably some of the top ones. You know, the first thing is always could be related to the setup, especially after you put in some new equipment or have some software upgrade, then you start to see problems. Those are quite a common cause. If you're running equipment for a long time, then the equipment can drift and you know, can cause some of those timing or synchronization type of problems. It's obvious equipment failure can cause problem, and communication link between different equipment can also cause DTV problems. And the consequence of those problems, you know, you will, could be the viewers cannot tune the programs entirely, or they can tune the program, but they can tune some programs, but not other programs. Or you can see lots of, you know, picture and audio breakups and lip sync problems. So all those are kind of typical, like, end result to the viewers. So what the ATSC A78, that's the measurement guideline, try to do? You know, we all know the two basic ATSC DTV standard. One is the A53 and the other is the A65, which is about a piece of. They are just the standard, and they don't tell you, you know, how to measure or how to monitor your DTV signal. And typically in the standard, they will just define a threshold. Everything, you know, within those boundary are good, and everything outside of the boundary are not so good. But there's no indication, you know, which violation of the standard is more important than the others. So the goals of the A78 is, first of all, kind of giving a common recommendation of how to measure the DTV stream. And they also want to kind of provide a useful guidelines for broadcasters to actually, if the problem happens, troubleshoot those problems. And they actually draw some of the things already implemented by the manufacturers. So they gave certain freedom for manufacturers how to implement this guideline. So this is just as a guideline instead of approved as a standard. Some major emphasis of this guideline is the first thing is this guideline wanted to grade different errors. You know, you because there are so many different parameters you can measure in a DTV transport stream. And if you measure all those errors with an analyzer, you know, it's very often the analyzer gave you like a red alarm all the time. But some of those red alarms are just not as important as others. You know, some data even literally violate the standard, but won't really cause any viewership problem. So this guideline, the first thing it tries to do is actually to grade different errors, you know, in terms of importance to the final viewership of your program. And it also categorizes different errors, so it will help you a little bit once you find the error to actually debug the problem. And as kind of mentioned already, you know, want to reduce the fourth alarm. Some of the things that will not really cause a problem, you can safely ignore them. Before ATSC took this effort, there was already an existing measurement guideline from DVB systems. I think it's originally called ETR11290. I think currently it's called ETSI TR11290. This is actually a pretty good guideline. It has a very detailed description of how to measure certain difficult parameters, like how to measure PCR. It also covers some of IF measurement. It also separates the different error types into three different priorities. Priority one tend to be the most important ones, and then you have it's kind of will affect, if you have a priority one error, it will affect your entire transport stream. Priority two are less important, but it's going to affect your individual programs, and the priority three is considered like application level errors. However, to direct using this guideline for ATSC stream is certainly adequate, because this is designed for DVB system, so it does not cover anything about the PSIP related information. And also, one thing the ATSC committee feel like it's lacking in this guideline is everything is still kind of black and white, either in spec or out of spec. Just to give you one example. For example, the MPEG requires the PAT table is repeated in the interval less than 100 milliseconds. So if you suddenly have a PAT repetition interval over 100 milliseconds, say just slightly over 100 milliseconds, say 105 milliseconds, it's not really going to affect anything on the viewership of your program. But based on ETR11290, that's going to be a priority one error. So that's the part, I guess, ATSC want to improve. So about 3 or 4 years ago, actually ATSC formed an ad hoc committee, and they started this effort to create ATSC own guideline. And of course, they look at the standard ETR11290, and they also kind of talked to some of the equipment manufacturers and collect some of the information some of the manufacturers have been already doing. And they also invite people from like encoder and the receiver manufacturers, broadcasters, and started to have this effort. And currently this is already approved, and it's labeled A78. And a similar guideline is approved by SCTE, and it's named ACTE 142. This standard covers only the transport stream data part. It does not cover anything related to the RF. So the conceptual measurement point is really the stream just before modulation. So you have an entire digital transport stream multiplexed and formed together, and it just started to modulate and broadcast. That is really the conceptual measurement point that the standard applies. The standard, first of all, categorizes errors into those five different categories. The first is MPEG metadata, PSI type errors. It's mainly just the PAT and the PMT errors. And the second category is the PSIP errors. And the third category is called timing and buffer errors. So those covers PCR, PTS, DTS, and audio and video buffer. And the fourth category is called consistency error. Just in the beginning, I show example, because there are duplicate informations between PSI and PSIP. So those informations, if they are talking about the same data, they should match. So those type of errors is, you know, called consistent errors. And there's the last category is general type errors, like a single byte loss, count recount error, or pit value is not in the range, you know, because ATS requires all the video, PMT, and audio pit should be above 0x30. So if any of those are less than 0x30, or is going to collide with some of the other ATAC defined private data, then those errors will also be measured. One, I guess, very significant improvement of this ATSC guideline is actually grade the errors into five different levels. The most serious level they call transport stream of error, or TOA type of error. The second one, less severe, is program of error, POA. And the next one is a component missing. The fourth one is a quality of service, QoS error. And the last one is just technically non-compliant. It's most likely not going to affect the viewership. So as its name indicates, transport stream of error means those type of errors is really going to cause the viewers not able to tune to your broadcast entirely. You know, one example says here is like absence of sync bytes, but something like a loss of PAT or loss of base piece of tables can cause those problems too. The second type of error is a program of error, which indicates, you know, the viewers can still see some of your program, but some other programs are missing. Those type of errors can be triggered by, you know, missing PMT or missing some of the virtual channel interests in virtual channel table. Component missing means missing some of those audio or video elementary stream data from your program. Missing some of like the electronic program guide information is also included in this category. Typical example is, you know, here says the mismatch of PID in your metadata, or actually the actual stream carried with this PID. QoS means, you know, the viewers can still see all those programs, or, but some of the programs just does not have any good quality. For example, you have some video breakups, some lip sync problems. Those type of problems are categorized as QoS. And the least significant is technically non-compliant. Those type of errors, just as I mentioned in the beginning, for example, you have a PAT error, the standard required repeat within 100 millisecond interval, but it's just slightly over. Some of those errors are actually harder to avoid, because when multiplexers, they put all the elementary stream, all the metadata, eventually max them together. Sometimes when you just get a burst of those data, like a burst, all those video and video streams are typically, you know, available bit late. When you have a complicated scene change, then you will have a burst of video data. The max, in order to kind of put all those video data within a required time frame, so they probably will push some of those metadata out a little bit. But in those cases, you're actually going to get a non-compliant, you know, error alarm. But those errors normally won't have any effect on the receivers. So those are categorized as a technical non-compliant. And those are really up to you whether you want to do something to fix it or not. So how actually, you know, kind of individual measurement or individual parameter are categorized into those different categories. And here is just one example about PAT. MPEG standard require PAT interval, repetition interval is below 100 milliseconds. So if based on this guideline, if you have a PAT interval is within, is above 100, but below 200 milliseconds, it is considered as a technically non-compliant. And if the interval is between 200 and 500 milliseconds, then this is considered as a QoS error. Because, you know, when you think about the receivers, it needed to wait 500 milliseconds to find a PAT. And then even if your PMT is within the repetition interval, that's based on MPEG-2 standard, it's 400 milliseconds. So you're talking about close to 1 second to discover the metadata, to discover. So that's probably a little bit too slow. That's why, based on this guideline, this is considered as a QoS. So it's going to slightly affect the quality of the service. And of course, if your PAT is not present in your transport stream, then no receivers can tune to the program. In this case, so it's considered the TOA, transport stream of error type of error. Of course, this is kind of still subjective. But I think it's better instead of say, okay, just when PAT exceeds 100 milliseconds, you say it's automatically trigger, you know, a priority one error or transport stream of error. So I think this grading system does help. I just want to show another example is you know, about the consistent type of error. So there could be a lot of actually different class table checking and consistency error. Here just to list a few examples. One example is like a PAT, both PAT and VCT, they will carry a transport stream ID. And if there are mismatch between the transport stream ID carried in PAT versus the transport stream carried in VCT, then potentially the receivers won't know how to do with those type of data. So this guideline suggests this is a TOA type of error. Another TOA type of error is you have multiple version of PAT, especially multiple version of PAT with different transport stream ID. That's situation is could be really bad. Sometimes you could even crash those setup box or multiplexers because your PAT is constantly changing. And most of the time, those setup box, once they see a new PAT, they throw out all the metadata they collected before. So if you have two versions of PAT just constantly coming every 100 milliseconds also, then the receivers is just going to constantly flash its cache, data cache, and it could cause a real significant problem. So this is kind of one type of TOA error. And there's some other errors like VCT, PMT mismatch. Those could, you know, either cause some of your programs cannot be tuned, or even you can tune to the program, some of the elements may be missing. So those are either POA or CM type of error. So how actually, you know, those guidelines can practically help the broadcasters? You know, from an equipment manufacturer point of view, you know, we implement this standard and we try to basically provide two features to you. One is once the error happens, we will announce what type of this error is. So you can see clearly, okay, well, this is a TNC error, you know, I'm busy, I'm not going to worry about it. Second of all, we actually provide a filtering mechanism. So you can actually say, okay, well, I'm only interested in errors above QoS. So any of errors that's just technically non-compliant to the standard will not show up at all. And I think this really can help you to debug. For example, you know, some of views, they can, for example, they actually got your signal from cable, and they say, I cannot tune to your program at all. And in this case, you probably want to see if you have transport stream of air type of error. So even, you know, if you don't configure this way, you know, just to look at based on the standard and major tons of different parameters, you know, your monitor probably going to have red alarm all over the place. But if now with this standard, you now actually can set the error filter to transport a stream of error, then all the other errors going to be just filtered out. And then essentially probably just going to left one or two errors. You're saying, okay, well, I'm seeing some sync byte error. You know, okay, well, something can probably cause the sync byte error. Then I will look at those equipment. Or sometimes even simple, if you just say, okay, there's a PSI error, and you say, okay, well, my PSI, PAT table is not there. So it really try to help you to debug this problem using error filtering. Okay, so this is pretty much the end of my talk. And just to summarize, this ATAC A78, first of all, try to provide a common methodology to describing ATAC DTV transport stream non-compliance. And secondly, it try to provide a methodology to help you to kind of troubleshoot your real-world type of problems. And we hope, you know, with the implementation of this standard by the equipment manufacturers, and it actually can, you know, help you solve the problem and reduce the time you spend troubleshooting your problem. That's the end of my talk. Anyone has any questions?
I got a quick one here for you. You mentioned lip sync.
Yes.
Do you have a solution that actually can detect a lip sync issue?
Well, we don't have a solution that actually specifically detect a lip sync problem. I think this is a pretty hard problem. It's a still, and even, you know, this standard does not have anything, you know, related to the how to actually measure the lip sync. So it's still, you know, because there are a few different things can cause lip sync, you know, the PCR, the, you know, timing related problem, audio or video buffer related problem. So I think you kind of still need using some kind of indirect way to measure the lip sync. I understand this is kind of still a challenge for kind of test equipment manufacturers to really consistent way provide a consistent way to measure the lip sync.
That was part of my question too. Why do some receivers seem to respond differently to lip sync errors?
Well, receivers can have different implementations. One of the cause of the lip sync could be like a video and audio buffer related issues. And different decoders, they can have different you know, physical memory to actually, you know, to kind of cache your video and audio data. And some decoders may handle those kind of situations a little bit better than the others. And of course, you know, when the decoders are running out of memory or they are not decoding fast enough, either video or audio, that can cause problem too. So if one decoder is just kind of get heavy loaded, you know, with decoding, and the video decoding suddenly becomes slower than the audio decoding, then you probably can see lip sync problem. So that, you know, I'm not too surprised, you know, those things will depend on decoder implementation.
All right, I guess that's it. Thank you very much.